And Luis said everybody starts this colloquium with the same joke about the hockey stick. So let me just point out that you can't use this without violating the rules, right? Because this is high sticking, I think. So that's about all I know about hockey. Which end are you supposed to use? Is it supposed to make this? I guess so. So in the way of being involved with young people, this is certainly it. It's really nice to see all the young faces here. It's certainly the best thing about my career is the continuing exposure to excited young people who come into the field of numerical relativity. And it really is a field that every generation, in principle, given if they're well-trained, motivated, have the right background, can do just orders of magnitude more than the previous generation. And so it's scary for anybody who's over 30, but it's I think really exciting to have that sort of a field. And it's largely because of the technology that drives things forward. And so full disclosure, all the work I'm going to talk about today, the actual hard work, was done by Franz Pretorius, who will be here next week. But it concerns a topic that we've discussed on and off for many, many years. So let me give you a summary of the talk. I'm going to give you the punchline relatively early, and then we'll get back to the details later. So the question is as follows. Particle collisions of sufficiently high energy lead to black hole formation and general relativity? So this is the question that we set out to answer. And a lot of people thought it was answered, and in some sense, I guess it was. So the answer is you're just going to have to wait for a few minutes, but I'm going to give you the answer. And I've sort of already given you a preview of that. Sorry about this. This is a screw up on my part with the PowerPoint. But the details, which will consume most of the talk, are basically the results are as we expected, but there's some interesting physics still to learn about the process. Okay, so again, let me rephrase the question. So do particle collisions of sufficiently high energy lead to black hole formation and general relativity? Just so you haven't forgotten that. This is the key thing that we're focused on here. And so let me just take a step back and ask, well, why are we particularly interested in that question at the current time? It's an interesting fundamental question, but of course, the reason that it's of interest now is because of the Large Hadron Collider. So you all know about the LHC, straddles the border between France and Switzerland in Geneva, or outside of Geneva. It's the world's largest high-energy particle accelerator. It's currently operational at CERN. Unfortunately, it's going to have to shut down for an extended period of time because they have to address the magnet issue. But eventually, if all goes as planned, it's going to collide protons, hadrons, at total energies of about 15 TeV. And of course, this is really big science, and there's lots of interesting science that's to be done. The thing that everybody expects, or most people expect that it's going to discover, is the Higgs boson. That's the last key element of the standard model of particle physics, which is unverified experimentally. That's what gives in the standard model, what gives all particles which have mass their mass. That would be interesting and certainly a very exciting result. But a lot of people are hoping that the LHC will also yield insights about physics beyond the standard model, things like supersymmetry, maybe something about why our universe is composed of matter and not of antimatter. And perhaps even something more exciting like large extra dimensions and the possibility of black hole formation. And you probably all, or most of you, have probably seen these news stories. So this is from the New York Times, March 29th, 2008. And what had happened at that point was that a person in Hawaii had talked to the Justice Department or was making noises about bringing a court order or trying to sue, basically, the Department of Energy to stop its involvement in a Large Hadron Collider. So just to read you this, so that Wagner and Sancho, content scientists at the European Center for Nuclear Research, have played down the chances that the collider could produce, horror of horrors, a tiny black hole, which they say could eat the Earth. And these people were very serious, and if you go on the web and you look around, you find lots of people who are still very concerned that the Large Hadron Collider could produce these small black holes. And of course, black holes gobble up everything, and so you know, the Earth's in danger and these scientists are being irresponsible and we should shut it down. Okay, so CERN actually had to take this seriously and they had to go, they commissioned more than one study, but at that time they were just finishing up a study. And this is just a great quote. In the, you know, so Maginot, he was part of the group that was you know, commissioned to do the study. The other people didn't want to go on the record about this, and you know, he states the possibility that a black hole eats up the Earth is too serious a threat to leave as a matter of argument amongst crackpots. So you'll have to decide at the end of the talk whether or not we're still crackpots, but nonetheless, we're going to go ahead and see what actually happens. Okay, so let's just take a step back even further and do one of these Fermi calculations, the sort of things that supervisors like to give grad students in qualifying exams and things like this, where we sort of just take the fundamental constants of nature and come up with a sort of an argument for when and where we might expect particle collisions, particle collisions to yield black holes. So we're going to consider two length scales that we can associate with a given amount of mass. Okay, so from quantum mechanics, we get the first length scale, and that's simply the de Broglie or the Compton wavelength associated with the mass of the particle. So we're going to come back to what we mean by particle, because that's going to play heavily into this description of the calculations. This particle has a mass m, and then using h and c, Planck's constant and the speed of light, we can construct this wavelength, which is simply proportional to 1 over the mass. Okay, and so that's one length scale, L sub c. The second length scale that we can construct is the so-called Schwarzschild radius. So what we do there is we imagine we take that amount of mass and we form a black hole out of it. And we let that black hole settle down and assume that it's a spherical black hole. Then there's a relationship between the mass and the size of the black hole. And, you know, it's a little bit ambiguous as to how you define the size of a black hole, but the way we'll do it is we'll take the surface, the event horizon, and we'll measure its proper surface area and then convert that into a length, and that will be the Schwarzschild radius. So that will denote L sub s, and that's given simply by 2 times Newton's constant divided by c squared times the mass. Okay? So we have those two length scales. And then from those, we can basically just, well, we take those two length scales and we equate them. And then the idea is, if this is sort of an elementary particle, a fundamental particle, then that's a particle, and it's going to be quite localized then, that's a particle which is sufficiently massive and sufficiently compact that it's essentially a black hole. Okay? So that's the idea. We just equate those wavelengths of the particle's Compton wavelength, the region in which it's localized, is essentially no bigger than its Schwarzschild radius, and so therefore it must be collapsed, must be a black hole. That's the basic reasoning. So equating those two length scales and ignoring the constants, we find that m squared is equal to hc over g, and m therefore is hc over g to the 1/2. And that's just the Planck mass. So not too surprising there that this is the fundamental mass that one gets from the fundamental constants. And so this is the basic heuristic argument that says if we were to be able to collide particles, so the total energy, total center of mass energy in the particle collision was the Planck scale, then we would expect to have black hole formation. Okay, and there's nothing more to the basic reasoning than that. We can also convert that to an energy, of course, simply by multiplying by c squared, and that's the Planck energy. So that's the first part of the story. So for collision energies above the Planck energy, black hole formation is at least plausible. Yeah?
So that's obvious, but I have a puzzle, which you can throw me out of court for this. Okay. Because the Planck mass has Planck's constant in it, which implies that the effect should be quantum mechanical, but you're going to be doing a classical calculation.
Yeah.
So let me ask the question this way. Supposing we took the limit of h bar to 0, which you would like to justify your calculation.
Well, just for the benefit of the rest of the audience, can I just go forward? Because there'll be a natural place to come back to that question about 3 slides.
Perfect.
Okay. All right. So now the question is, do particle collisions of super Planck energy then lead to black hole formation and general relativity? So we've made the question slightly more precise, but it's still this issue, is if we get the energy up sufficiently high, are we going to get black hole formation? And the answer is yes. Okay. So when we set out on these calculations, for reasons I'm going to tell you about, it wasn't obviously clear to us what the answer would be, although everybody who'd sort of done the heuristic arguments and had looked at this problem thought that black hole formation was going to be possible. So I'll return to this diagram at the end of the talk. But basically what you're looking at here results from a calculation that's done in 3 plus 1 dimensions, but with an axisymmetry, where there's a symmetry axis here. So there's a rotational axis, rotational symmetry about a z-axis, if you will. These are our two particles, and what's being rendered here you can think of as isocontours of density. So these are particles which are spherical in their rest frames, but which have been Lorentz boosted with Lorentz boosts of factors gamma, equal and opposite, where gamma is simply square root 1 over the square root of 1 minus b squared over c squared as usual. And the energy then is simply gamma times mc squared. Okay? And it's nice that you can see the actual Lorentz contraction of these particles in the lab frame. Okay? And then at a later time, they're colliding here. Even later time, they're emerging. So this is the particle going this way, and this is the particle going that way. At late times, you're getting all sorts of interesting structure, but here at the center, there's a black hole. So one observation here is that these particles are not infinitesimal. They're not particles. So we have models of particles that we can make small, in some sense, but which are nonetheless non-singular, completely regular descriptions, and we'll come back to that in a little bit. So that's the basic answer. Okay? So now let me go into the details, sort of set up the straw man, sort of tell you why this wasn't so obvious, at least to us, a little more about the calculation, and then some of the outstanding open questions. So I'd like to go through, sorry, it was more than three slides, but it's coming. I'd like to go through the standard chain of reasoning that goes a little bit deeper than that Fermi argument as to why we should expect black hole production out of particle collisions. And then point out some possible weak links in that chain. Okay? Then I'll talk a little bit about this non-singular model for particles, so-called boson stars, get to the results, and focus on the open questions, which is what happens at the threshold of black hole formation in these kinds of collisions, because that's something that I continue to be interested in and I think is one of the key things that we still don't understand. So a lot of this can be understood, at least gravitationally, in terms of what Thorne called the hoop conjecture. And so in the volume that was published in honor of John Wheeler's 60th birthday, Thorne formulated this conjecture as sort of a necessary and sufficient condition for when you should expect black holes to form. And it's not very precise. It's not a mathematically precise definition. But over the years, it's sort of encapsulated a lot of what people think about when they think about conditions for black hole formation. And so the idea, again, you consider a mass m. So there may be some difficulty in actually defining that mass in general, but let's say we can do that. And then the idea is essentially you construct a hoop, a little hula hoop, whose circumference is given by 2 pi times the Schwarzschild radius. So you imagine converting all that mass into a black hole. That defines that radius. You make a hoop with a circumference 2 pi times that. And then you consider that the matter distribution, whatever it is that's defining that mass. And as long as you can take that hoop and pass it around that object in all directions, then the conjecture is that configuration has to collapse and form a black hole. Which almost sounds obvious the way that I've described it, but it's not completely obvious. And one way that you can think that you might be able to get around it, and people have studied this for a long time, is if you imagine a very, very long, a basic, almost linear question of mass. In fact, this sort of came out of Thorne's thesis, PhD thesis, in which he studied cylindrical collapse of matter. So with a cylindrical symmetry, you have a rotational symmetry and time translational symmetry. There you can get very strong field effects. You could essentially have an arbitrary small amount of, a large amount of matter that kind of gets condensed down around the symmetry axis during a collapse process. But clearly, there's no hoop at all that you can pass around things in that direction, because that direction goes infinitely out, you know, to plus and minus infinity. And so from the point of view of the hoop conjecture, then, cylindrical systems can never form black holes. And in fact, that's been proven. Okay. So again, the thing to keep in your mind is we have this little hoop that's whose circumference is correlated to the mass of the black hole that would form if the mass collapsed. And as long as we can pass that hoop around all directions around the object, then the claim is we should get a black hole. Well, that's a good question. And that's why, you know, basically you can't define this conjecture precisely, because we still don't have a good definition of mass, quasi-local. There's reasons to believe you probably never will be able to in the fully general case. So, no, I don't think Thorne was ever thinking of this as being mathematically precise. Although I think there are probably versions of the hoop conjecture that could be made mathematically precise using the kind of ideas that Gerhard Huchsen and other people have been thinking about in terms of defining mass geometrically, so-called isoperimetric mass and stuff, which is analogous to, you know, measuring the linear density of something, of a string, by measuring the deficit angle, you know. So I think some aspects of these can be made precise.
Mass is not an observer at infinity, sees as mass, or is that?
Well, no. Here you'd have to have some notion of local mass for sure.
Oh, really?
Because yeah, you want to be able to apply it in situations like you just saw with those two particles, where a lot of the mass.
But horizon is not local.
That's right. That's right. But so you don't need a horizon necessarily in order to deduce that you've got a black hole if you're willing to assume cosmic censorship. So you can, if you have an apparent horizon or trapped surface, and you assume cosmic censorship, then black hole follows. Okay. So the hoop conjecture certainly seems reasonable, but you know you have to be careful about how you interpret it. And so the domain of applicability is certainly not clear, because if we take a single particle and we boost it to arbitrarily high velocities, then, and we're all sitting in the same rest frame, but the particle with mass m is moving with arbitrarily large velocities, then that particle, to us, its effective hoop size gets larger and larger and larger as we boost it. And so it would seem, okay, if we boost it a certain amount, then it should collapse. But from the point of view of the particle, there's absolutely, in fact, from everybody's point of view, boosting the particle does not generate any real gravitational effects. There's no curvature being generated. Okay, so somehow, you know, these hoop conjecture arguments don't capture everything. And so for the case of two particles, it really is important that there be two particles. So let's just, again, schematically think of what's going on here then. So here we have a case, two particles, identical masses m, boost factors gamma, and this is relatively low gamma. And so here I've drawn the hoop that has a radius 2 times 2 gamma times m. Okay, and that hoop size isn't going to change because the total mass in the system is constant. And the idea is when they collide now, clearly the particles are too large, and so they're completely overlapping here. But, you know, the hoop is too small, so there's no gravitational collapse. Okay. So we boost things a little bit more. They get Lorentz contracted in the transverse direction. The hoop is a little bit bigger. They collide. But still, you know, the hoop's not big enough. Now it's just big enough to go around in the transverse direction, but it's in this transverse, in this direction, but it's not big enough to go in the transverse direction. Okay, so the thing is still kind of too prolate in that direction. No collapse. And then finally, if we really boost them, then the, you know, the hoop is even larger. And when they collide, sure enough, now they're sitting in, well inside the hoop radius, and so, again, black hole formation should be plausible in most cases. But the thing to keep in mind is, in this kind of Gedanken-type experiment, if I took out one of those particles, I would still have a hoop here from that point of view, and there's just, no matter how large the hoop gets, there's no gravitational collapse. So there is something about the fact that there are two particles that are interacting, and the energy is somehow localized that eventually leads to black hole formation. Okay, I'm now going to talk only in natural units, so G bar and C and H bar, C and H bar, and sometimes constants. If I've screwed up in calculations, I'll be set to one. I'm not going to give any references in this discussion of the standard story, but there's lots of online material available, and in particular Steve Giddings over the years has been a big proponent of black hole production, and so his articles are very well written and a good source of information. It was way more than three. But believe me, there's a natural place. Okay, so let me go through the standard scenario for black hole formation. Yeah, good. In accelerators such as the LHC. So the first thing is the space needs more dimensions. Okay? Now, if you're a string theorist, well, this is obvious, right? And this is axiomatic. And, so string theories require additional dimensions for mathematical and physical consistency. So if we have a total of d dimensions and d minus 1 spatial, then d minus 1 is 10 or 9, I guess, depending on how you count. So we're going to assume some string theory, and we're going to assume that extra dimensions are compact and small, but they're not necessarily the order of the four-dimensional Planck length, that is 10 to the minus 33 centimeters or equivalently 10 to the 19th GeV. Okay. So the basic idea is that the world is truly d-dimensional, and it's that Planck mass associated with the d dimensions that's the important one for black hole formation, not our four-dimensional Planck scale. The one that's going to govern black hole formation is the d-dimensional. And then we need a mechanism to get the d-dimensional Planck energy way, way down in scale to low energies, and in particular to TeV energies. Okay? So it won't surprise you to know that in the 1990s, people came up with this mechanism when the LHC was starting to build it, and it was getting an exciting time thinking about these new particle experiments. People started saying, well, what if this interesting physics that could happen at TeV scales? And you might be a little bit skeptical. The particle physicist saying, well, yeah, there's going to be interesting physics happening here at the TeV scale because they're building a TeV scale accelerator. But there actually was a rationalization for it, namely that if you had this kind of Planck scale being at the d-dimensional Planck scale being at the TeV scale, then you could solve the so-called hierarchy problem of particle physics. That is, why is there such a gap between our four-dimensional Planck scale and the other scales of the interactions? So there's a couple of those scenarios that have been around since the 90s. One goes by the name of large extra dimensions, and the other large warping with brain world scenario. And for the large warping scenario, just to pick one of the examples, the space-time metric gets written in this form. So we have our four-dimensional metric, our metric, gets pre-multiplied by this warping factor, e to the 2ay, where the y coordinates run over the internal dimensions. Okay, so now we have a metric on the internal dimensions, so m and n are running from 5 to d. And from that, you can work out the relationship, essentially, between the volume in one space and the volume in the other space, or equivalently, between the four-dimensional Planck mass and the d-dimensional Planck mass, where this is an exponent, d to the power d minus 2, and this is mass squared. So if this volume is sufficiently large, which basically boils down to the dimensions themselves being sufficiently large, then you can get the d-dimensional Planck mass to be much, much less than 10 to the 19th GeV. In fact, you can get it down to the order of 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4 GeV, which is interesting. So that's the basic idea. Okay, so now there's the transparency. And I don't fully understand the details, but the claim is, if we now consider energies which are much larger than the Planck scale, then the quantum gravity effects will be ignorable because they're essentially going to be suppressed by powers of md over e. So whether or not you buy that, I don't know. But that's the basic argument. Because everything that's done, you know, in the particle physics community and the gravitational physics community to discuss, to address this issue of whether or not black holes can be formed at the LHC is done using classical gravity. There's just no doubt about it because we don't have a quantum gravity theory. That's the assumption. So if you, okay, so.
Supposing that your argument is right, and I'm going to reason in four dimensions, even though I understand that the issue is very dimensional. Supposing for fixed H bar and for fixed G, which is where the argument is being made, the argument is correct. Okay? That is that if you had a particle of mass greater than the Planck mass, it would collapse to a black hole and therefore be unstable. Then the question I want to ask is that should be true for every H bar and every G. And you're making some part of the argument that you're making is precise, the quantum classical relativity, and part of it is conjectural because H bar is still finite, otherwise you couldn't make the argument. Okay. But if the argument is true for every H bar and G, then it's true in a limit which I take H bar to zero and G to zero, but keep their ratio, which is the Planck max, fixed. And then I would conclude that in that world, which is H bar equals zero and G equals zero, which is classical physics, there can't be a stable particle heavier than the Planck mass.
Heavier than the Planck mass?
Yeah, because there, for finite H bar and finite G, there can't be.
So, but that's what the claim would be anyways. A stable particle heavier than the Planck mass or lighter than the Planck mass?
Heavier. There can't be a stable particle heavier than the Planck mass.
Okay.
No. But in a theory described by the limit H bar goes to zero, G goes to zero, which is just classical mechanics.
Yeah.
So do we have to invent that weird version of classical mechanics where there are no stable particles heavier than the Planck mass?
Well, but there's no concept of Planck mass in the classical limit, so I
don't know. No, there is, because the ratio, Planck mass is the ratio of H bar.
Well, okay, so let me back off a little bit and say that what we're studying, though, is purely classical. So
the rest of the argument is where my question arises. The part of your argument which is heuristic, which is on this
side. No. But I mean, even the calculations, so irrespective, so for you then, if that's a paradox, there's still the issue of whether or not in general relativity, classical particles boosted to sufficiently high energies actually cause black holes. Okay. Right. So I don't think I agree, though, with that. Well, I'm not sure that I completely understand, but I'm not sure that there is a paradox there.
But there is either, but it addresses that first line, the validity of the argument in that first line.
Yeah, well, but...
Is there something special about gravity or this extra D gravity that makes the first assumption valid? Because usually if I'm at an energy scale, like, for example, if I'm above the electroweak energy scale, I expect electroweak effects
production
to be important, not negligible.
Yeah. I have to
admit, it's a bit, so if I'm much less than the Planck mass, quantum gravity is ignorable. If I'm much greater, it's ignorable. I mean,
And if you're
when is it not ignorable?
When you're above that scale, exactly.
But what is it that's about gravity that makes this argument believable relative to the other forces?
I don't know. I don't think it's purely gravity.
I don't think it's purely gravity. Yeah. What it's talking about is the Eichonaut approximation of particle physics. High momentum transfer, the computation you're doing is just ignoring any H bar effects. And then the action is big. So quantum mechanics is S over H bar.
Yeah.
If you have a big S, quantum mechanics is irrelevant. So it's the same thing, Eichonaut approximation of QCD.
Well, except that gravity strongly couples to itself, presumably above the Planck scale.
Right. Then the claim is that becomes a purely classical effect.
Yeah.
Anyway, it is not for us. I don't think in this seminar to decide whether or not that's
okay. All right.
It's a straw man to begin with, right? And there's more steps in the chain. Okay. So let's take it as granted.
Okay.
All right. All right, so if that is the case, then we're going to assume that we can describe the high energy collision of fundamental particles as a classical process, which is going to be characterized by this relative boost parameter and an impact parameter. But we'll subsequently set the impact parameter to zero because those are the only calculations that we can afford to do at the current time. We're going to further assume that for large gamma, we can actually approximate it by the gamma goes to infinity limit or perturbation theory about that solution. So that from the general relativistic point of view, then, the space-time that we're going to be interested in is that of an infinitely boosted particle. Okay? And a long time ago, Peter Eckelberg and Sexel worked out what... Yes, sir.
I mean, just because you said to zero, and then you won't have the chance to ask again.
Yes.
So, I mean, I think that there should be a dependence in terms of do you form a black hole or not on the impact parameter.
Absolutely.
Is it true that when that is large enough, the two particles just miss each other and don't form anything?
Absolutely.
So you would expect a continuous transition when you increase...
Well, that's a good question. And we'll get that. We'll get to that at the end. Okay. So in 1971, Eckelberg and Sexel actually did that calculation. So they took the Schwarzschild metric, and they boosted the Schwarzschild metric, essentially, by taking the limit gamma goes to infinity, but keeping the lab frame energy, that is one component of the four momentum, fixed. And the metric that they found, so the metric is being boosted in the x direction, so there's a flat space-time part, and then there's this part, and that's an actual Dirac delta function, which should be worrisome to those of you who know anything about general relativity, because how can the metric be distributional? But it turns out that the coordinate system that they're using, being sort of being generated from the usual Schwarzschild coordinates, is pretty pathological. So a lot of the pathologies in the line element here can be traced back to the coordinate system. And you can do a singular coordinate transformation to rewrite this metric, so the metric and its first derivatives are continuous, but that's it. Second derivatives are discontinuous, and so this metric actually has shocks in the curvature. And in fact, the shocks are confined to the location of this particle that's been now compressed down so it's infinitely thin. And the metric actually is a pure gravitational wave metric, which describes a shock, an impulsive fronted wave propagating in the x direction with distributional curvature. Now, because the metric is flat everywhere outside of that surface along which the particle, the null particle, is now propagating, you can take two of those solutions representing two of the particles that are colliding and piece together, sort of glue together the space-times, and the only part of the space-time that you can't explicitly construct is the space-time that lies to the future of the collision inside the sort of the light cone that's generated by the colliding two particles. Okay? And so in a very famous piece of work that everybody cites but nobody can find because it was only given as a seminar, Penrose... but there were people in the seminar who could still remember it. Penrose analyzed that geometry and found that on the surfaces, these null surfaces, you would get focusing after the collision of the two particles, and that eventually you would get black hole formation. So, well, actually, you get an apparent horizon, and then assuming cosmic censorship, which is fine because, after all, he defined it. So the cosmic... you would get a apparent horizon, and therefore, if you can assume cosmic censorship, you get a black hole. Okay? So here's a really cartoonish diagram of what's going on. We've got one of these plane fronts propagating this way. So this is time running, space running this way. Another one coming in here, flat, 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 distributional curvature along here, distributional curvature along here, and a curved mass in here. But along these surfaces, you can do this analysis and come to the conclusion that a black hole would form. And it's that construction that everybody was basing all their work on. So in 2002, Eardley and Giddings sort of reworked what Penrose had done, extended it to the d-dimensional case, did some additional work. And since then, there's just been like a real industry in calculating exactly what should happen from black hole collisions, including the particle production, because the way the black holes are going to be detected if they form at LHC, so the conventional wisdom goes, is basically through the Hawking radiation process that's going to produce, essentially every possible particle. And that's how you're going to detect those black holes, is through their decay product. But we won't be discussing that. That's the standard story. But it's really this issue of whether or not the Ekelberg-Sexel solution is an appropriate approximation for finite particles which have been boosted to a finite gamma and that are colliding, which was under question. So why are there possible problems with that standard scenario? Okay, so the first thing is the metric's not asymptotically flat, so it can't, in any precise sense, describe, you know, two finite particles with finite energy. Now, you talk to it's not. So it's sort of very weakly not asymptotically flat, but if you look at the asymptotic structure, there's insufficient fall off in the metric functions.
But Schwarzschild is asymptotically flat.
That's right.
And if you boost...
That's right. If you take the infinite... You see, that's the thing. It's right. So that's related to this statement that the Petrov type is actually different. So for those of you who are not familiar with the Petrov classification, essentially look at the Riemann tensor and you analyze its eigenvalue structure. And so there's a change in type of the metric. So it starts off to be type D, where it has two distinct null eigenvectors of the Weyl tensor, which in some sense encodes the gravitational radiation content of the curvature, to a Petrov type N, where there's one null eigenvector, and that's a pure gravitational wave system. So in particular, type D solutions have associated with them some Coulomb part of a gravitational field, some rest frame mass, which is lost when you take that limit. Okay. Another thing is that the metric doesn't really provide a good description of a particle which has been boosted with a finite gamma. Okay, so it's really difficult to work with that metric and see how it corresponds to some particle which has been given a finite boost. But perhaps for us, the thing that really provided a lot of our confusion and some of the motivation for the calculation is we had indications from early calculations that I'm going to show you which suggests that gravity could actually weaken for high impact parameter, for high energy collisions. And so therefore, we were interested in just going ahead and trying to do this calculation, which had never been done, right? So everybody assumed that things would work out, but the actual detailed modeling hadn't been done before. So our strategy then is to assume that the calculations in 3+1 dimensions, so we'll work in 4 dimensions with an axisymmetry, can shed light on the higher dimensional calculations, which is what everybody assumes anyway. And we're going to investigate the collision of particles, but to get away from the problem that if we have, you know, real point particles, then we have singularities and we don't know how to couple them to the gravitational field, we'll use models for particles which are non-singular. And we're going to start with head-on collisions because we viewed that as a necessary condition for everything to work here. Of course, you're never going to have an exactly head-on collision even, you know, in a particle physics experiment. But clearly, if you couldn't form them from head-on collisions, it would seem very, very unlikely that you'd be able to form them with finite impact parameters. And so we also wanted to use the simplest matter model we could with an understanding that ultimately we would try to check our results with different kinds of interactions. So the simplest model we could come up with, the other thing is we needed some model where there'd be some self-gravitation to begin with so that we wouldn't have some significant self-gravitation to begin with, so that we wouldn't have to go to enormously high gammas in order to sort of probe the Hoopp conjecture kind of regimes. And there's a very convenient model that we can adopt, which is known as a boson star. And they're actually very easy to construct. All you need is a complex scalar field with some sort of self-interaction potential. And that self-interaction potential, when you couple it to gravity, can be as simple as just a mass term. And in fact, that's what we're going to do. So its Lagrangian density is just given by the usual kinetic energy term minus some potential. And for the purposes of this talk, just think of the potential as being 1/2 m squared phi squared. So we're just going to have a mass. We then solve the coupled Einstein, Clyde, and Gordon equations. So there's the Einstein equations, there's the stress tensor for complex scalar field, and there's the Klein-Gordon equation. And then we looked for static spherically symmetric solutions. So there was a couple of groups in Princeton who did this in the late 60s, and again, quite easy to find these solutions. So we adopt Schwarzschild-like coordinates. This R measures proper surface area. We have two unknown metric functions, alpha and A, not really important. The key thing is you adopt this ansatz for the complex scalar field. So the time ansatz is harmonic. We have an e to the I omega t, where omega turns out to be an eigenvalue of the problem, times some spatial profile. Okay, so internally at every point in space, you've got this complex field rotating around, right? So it's really got some dynamics, and the time scale of that dynamics is essentially for a massive field set by the mass. But everything that appears in the stress tensor is essentially only dependent on the magnitude of the scalar field. And so that internal dynamics doesn't change the stress energy distribution. Okay, so you can have a static space-time while you've got this internal dynamics going on. So you can actually find different kinds of stars for essentially arbitrary potentials as long as they're bounded. And so again, the simplest one is to have a mass term. We're going to set this particle mass equal to 1. And the mini comes nomenclature comes about, so they're often called mini boson stars. And it comes about because when these things were first investigated, it was quickly discovered that for sort of reasonable particle masses, these things wouldn't be of interest astrophysically. You know, way less than the Earth, right? So from time to time, they pop up as possible dark matter candidates and then maybe even for constituting halos of galaxies. But there you generally need to put in some sort of a non-trivial potential, because if you add different terms in the potential, then you can certainly get larger masses. A key thing is that there's an entire, for any fixed value, for any fixed potential, there's a one-parameter family of solutions, which you can conveniently parameterize by something which is effectively the central density. Just as in with relativistic stars, you can characterize them by the central density. So we just take the modulus, the central modulus of that profile function, which is the central modulus of the complex scalar field, call that phi sub zero. And then you have to get the right value of omega as a function of phi zero. But once you have that, you get this nice family of static spherically symmetric stars. And it shares with fluid stars some key gravitational properties, including the fact that if you plot the total gravitating mass as a function of this central density, it increases the way you would expect the total mass to do for increasing density, but only up to a certain point, after which the total mass actually starts to decrease as you have increasing central density. And in fact, density increases everywhere, but the total mass decreases, and this should seem to you an unstable situation. Okay, and it is. And at least heuristically, you can understand that as coming from the fact that in general relativity, all forms of energy coupled with gravitational field, including the gravitational field itself, gravitational energy, loosely speaking, is negative. When you're in this situation, the total amount of positive rest mass energy that you get by increasing the density is more than compensated by negative gravitational potential energy due to the addition of the mass, but because the gravitational field is becoming increasingly strong. Okay? And sure enough, stars over here are unstable. They're unstable to collapse or to basically propagating back to the stable branch here and executing large oscillations. And everywhere where there's a maxima or a minima here, you pick up an additional unstable mode. So for those of you who know something about critical phenomena, critical collapse, these are one-mode unstable solutions. Okay, and so they actually can sit at the threshold of gravitational collapse. So for this model, it's, you know, 0.6 Planck masses. Okay, so everything now is in Planck masses. So order unity. So the stars we're going to be using are sitting here. So they're close to that, the Planck mass limit already, but you have to get the gamma up to about 10 before you would expect the Hoop conjecture argument to cut in.
Becomes negative?
Omega never becomes negative.
Okay.
It's only in perturbation theory. Okay, so the stars are always static, right? But if you do perturbation theory, then they're growing modes. Whereas over here, when you do perturbation theory, the modes are purely oscillatory. Okay, so omega
of the perturbation then becomes
omega is always positive, right? So omega being positive means that there's a static solution, no matter what value we're finding up. Okay? So the complex field remains stable. Remains static. Right, and that's the background solution, and then the perturbation changes sign.
Sorry, to just clarify, so if I pick some value of m and phi naught to the right of that line, that's unstable to gravitational collapse.
Well, here, it's unstable
to go back
undergo these.
But if I pick a value that's, let's say, at the bottom or the top, then there's more instability than even
that's
that.
Right.
And what is that additional instability?
We don't, as far as I know, we don't know yet, you know, what exactly would happen there.
So that's...
It's probably... Yeah.
So that's not understood.
No, it's not understood.
Hey, why did you say it comes back up?
Well, I'll show you later, if I get there. So everybody would expect to collapse, but this is one of the things that we've learned from critical collapse that... I'll get back to it. Okay, so this quickly, you can also play this game in Newtonian theory, in which case your system of equations reduces to the Schrodinger equation coupled to the Newtonian equation for gravitational potential. So if you took your first year quantum mechanics class, graduate class, and you say write down the equations for, you know, a quantum mechanical particle coupled to the Newtonian gravitational field, that's what you'd get. Okay, so the V here is generated classically by the solution of this Poisson equation, and that's just a Schrodinger equation where phi is complex. You can make the same ansatz as you did before. You get a one-parameter family of solutions, but this time they're essentially all the same solution. There's a simple rescaling, and the mass is simply a monotonic function of the central density. There's no turnover. So really only one solution. Okay, but we're going to see some results with these Newtonian boson stars. So now we're back to that key question. What happens then when these boson stars collide when the boost factor is relatively large? And I'm going to show you results from three separate calculations. And the first two gave us these indications that there might be something, that there definitely was something interesting going on, and that perhaps the answer of whether or not black holes would form wasn't completely obvious. And then I'll get to the most recent results. So here's the results from a calculation of Newtonian boson stars. These were done in axis symmetry, and this is a cut along the axis of symmetry. And we have one pulse here. These stars aren't of the same mass, and they're boosted to get towards one another. So as time proceeds, they merge. And if you can see this, you can see all these oscillations. So this is just interference. Right, so you can think about it as quantum mechanical interference, but it's just, you know, the interference that you get because these guys are both satisfying wave equations. So there's this interference pattern, but then the stars reemerge, and they continue on their merry way. And for the most part, apart from the fact that these have become a little bit compressed, you know, there's the solutions retain their integrity. So there's sort of the solitonic aspect of this interaction, which you certainly don't have if you don't put in the coupling to gravity. If you don't have the coupling to gravity, then these wave packets simply spread out, right? And they certainly don't maintain any sort of a solitonic nature. And it's interesting that you get this, you see the similar behavior if you replace that gravitational self-interaction by a cubic term. That is, you study the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. Yeah. Well, this is Newtonian calculation. And the reason that he did that was because if you do them equal, then people always ask, well, how do you know they passed through one another and they didn't bounce off? Which is, you know, kind of hard to prove anyways. But here, at least, you know, it looks like they passed through because the tall one came out going to the left like it started.
It looks like the little one and the big one are taller. So
they've been compressed.
All right, they've been compressed.
Yes, but, you know, relatively low resolution, blah, 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 you know, numerical caveats. So I wouldn't read too much into that. All right, so now on to the relativistic case. So the stars you're going to see being collided were chosen. This was the configuration here, well away from the maximum mass, identical stars. And the thing to do we're doing now is we're investigating the behavior as a function of the magnitude of the boost. All right, so now the animations. So all these animations are going to be showing the modulus of the scalar field. So again, you can think of this, loosely speaking, as a density. And in the rendering, the color map is redundant with the height field. This is the axis of symmetry. The stars will approach one another. And here they start from rest. So they propagate towards one another, and then they merge. And you get what is apparently a stable boson star at the end that oscillates some perturbations, but nothing much interesting happens apart from that. Okay, so that was starting from rest. And the final state is an excited boson star. Now we give those stars small initial boosts, identical boosts towards one another. And so they merge, and they execute some dynamics. And then at late times, you'll see this really spike up, and the code crashes. And for experts in numerical relativity, at least back then, that was a good indication that there was a black hole. And in fact, you know, we could detect apparent horizons, and sure enough, you know, black hole forms in that case. So you know, start from rest, no black hole, a little bit of velocity, you get a black hole, and so we give the star is now a large, relatively large initial velocity, and they go right through one another. Okay? So, wasn't clear what's going to happen in the large gamma limit, right? Okay, so the stars pass through one another, but we weren't yet in the regime where the Hoop conjecture should say you should see a black hole. Okay? But we were in a regime where you could form black holes because we'd seen black holes form with smaller amounts of energy in the system. Okay, so now what you're going to see are the calculations the Franz and I recently did. They show four distinct cases. It's supposed to be necessary and sufficient, but then the question is, what does the necessary, what does the sufficient mean, right? In some sense, I don't even know. I have never asked Kip exactly what he meant. Okay, and I'll point this out. It's certainly the case that we know that we can tell in calculations that a black hole will form even when 2m over r is well bounded away from 1. So in that sense, it's not necessary, if you will. Okay, but the question is whether you're supposed to apply it throughout the calculation or just at instance of time. Yeah, exactly. Okay, so we're going to be looking at gamma 1, 2, 4, and then 3.125. So this is, you know, starting from rest. Fully general relativistic calculation. So the intermediate times, there's no black hole form. There's sort of this excited boson star. If you run the calculation long enough, it eventually collapses to a black hole. But, you know, it's probably due to subsequent dynamics and not to the collision process itself. Take gamma a little bit larger, and sure enough, we get that same sort of behavior, but now the particles pass through one another. We have that solitonic kind of behavior. I should also point out that a lot of the effects that you'll see here are at least partly due to the choice of coordinates, which is a very tricky business in this kind of calculation. So you can't read a lot into the physics sometimes just from these animations. So now this is gamma equals 4. The Hoop conjecture, based on these rough orders of magnitude estimates, would say that we need to get to gamma equals 11 or 12. So gamma equals 4, quite flattened particles. See that nice interference pattern. And this is an apparent horizon. And it looks like it's shrinking, but again, that's a coordinate effect. The black hole is actually growing in size. Okay. And so those were the first calculations where people had actually taken models for particles and shown that they form black holes. Now, this is an intermediate value between that solitonic regime and the black hole formation. So, you know, we're really interested always when we find one of these transitions to see what exactly is happening at the threshold of black hole formation. And so you can see that there's quite a lot of interesting dynamics, and you see those sort of secondary wave fronts forming, and those were responsible for the big arcs that we saw in the first still images I showed early in the talk. And here's a detail of that. Okay, so do collisions of particles at sufficiently high energy necessarily form black holes? The answer, as far as we can tell, is yes, which is what most people expected. And in fact, for the case of these mini boson stars, you apparently form them for gamma of about one-third of what you might think from naive Hoop conjecture arguments. However, getting back to this point, for stable boson stars, the maximum 2m over r is certainly bounded by about 0.5. And even for a massless scalar field, the largest values that you typically see for that function, 2m over r, for configurations which do not collapse is about 1/2. Right? So in other words, it remains very difficult to come up with stable gravitational configurations where that factor 2m over r really approaches 1. You know, there's this well-known limit of 8/9 for perfect fluids that comes from causality, but no one's ever been able to get any kind of a realistic configuration, either from fundamental fields or from fluid star models that approaches that. So perhaps in view of that, that factor of 1/3 isn't so surprising. And the key open question, if you'll bear with me for just a few more minutes, is what happens at the threshold of black hole formation? So what we've learned over the past almost 20 years now is that when we look at models for gravitational collapse and black hole formation, that the process of black hole formation has a lot in common with phase transitions. It's a nonlinear phenomena. And in fact, the mathematics which underlies it is precisely the mathematics that one uses to understand critical phenomena in statistical mechanical systems. And the amusing thing is whereas in statistical mechanical systems, the mathematics is only an approximation, because it's always done in the context of some sort of effective classical field theory that comes out of the calculations. Here, the mathematics is exact. So all the symmetry sort of ideas and the self-similarity, both sorts of things that we see are exact properties of the partial differential equations and not due to some sort of an approximation. So the black hole transitions come in two types. If we consider a generic parameter, such as the boost parameter, which controls how strong the gravitational interaction gets.
Relativity is an effective field theory.
No, but within the context of those partial differential equations, right, then the critical behavior is, there's no approximations made after
that's
that.
That's right, but I'm saying generativity is an approximation.
One assumes.
Yes.
Okay. All right, so this parameter then will generically control how strong the gravitational interaction is. So, for example, gamma is a good parameter. And we'll have a black hole free regime for low values of the parameter. And then at some point, black hole formation will start. And if we plot the mass of the black hole, then there are two possibilities. Either the first black hole forms at a finite mass, we'll call that a type 1 transition, an analog with a first order phase transition, or it will form an infinitesimal mass. Not at zero mass, because there's no way that one can define a zero mass black hole, but an infinitesimal mass. And we'll call that a second order phase transition. And we've seen both kinds of transitions in models of gravitational collapse. And I'm going to show you a bewildering bunch of animations here. But this is the one that gets back to the question of whether or not those one mode unstable solutions will always collapse to a black hole. So what I've done for this perfect fluid, what Scott Noble has done, and he'll be here next week, is there's a similar sort of plot for fluid stars. And we start with a star that's sitting here, and we perturb it gravitationally by imploding some massless scalar field into it. So the only coupling is through the gravitational field. There's no explicit coupling between the scalar field and the fluid. But the star feels the scalar field when it's inside it, and it compresses it. And by tuning the strength of the scalar field, we can either compress it a little bit so it just sort of sits in its star state and doesn't do much, or we can kick it over to black hole formation. And so there's a threshold. And if you tune to the critical point, then what you do is you tune to one of these unstable solutions, right? But then if you're supercritical, if you're above the critical parameter, the configuration will collapse to form a black hole. If you're below it, rather than collapsing, it propagates back to the stable branch and executes these big oscillations. So in other words, a star that's sitting there is unstable, but not just to collapse. It's unstable to going back to the stable branch with big perturbations. So that's exactly what you're going to see here. So this star, here's the scalar field coming in here. You can barely see it. It's going to come in very, very quickly. It's going to perturb the perfect fluid into a more condensed state. And then it relaxes back and executes these large amplitude oscillations. Right? So that state, that intermediate state here, well, let me run it again. This state is unstable. But you can tune to it, and by doing sufficient fine-tuning, you can get that state to persist longer and longer. It's exactly analogous to, in principle, you know, you can balance a pencil on the tip, the sharpened tip, but you have to adjust, you know, tune away an unstable mode to infinite precision. You see the similar sort of behavior with an SU2 Yang-Mills field, which is coupled to the gravitational field. There's two calculations here where values of that tuning parameter have been tuned to a part in 10 to the 16. Okay, so as close as you can come in double precision arithmetic. The configuration on the top at late time disperses. The configuration at the bottom forms a black hole. And in this case, the intermediate state, for those of you who know this field, is a so-called N equals 1 Bartnik-McKinnon solution, which is a kink profile. So it's balanced between the Yang-Mills sort of effective repulsive interaction. It's a massless Yang-Mills field, but the dimensional reduction into spherical symmetry gives you a non-trivial potential that essentially is a repulsive potential. That balances off against the gravitational interaction, and you have that unstable kink. But at late times, you either have that kink completely disperse or it collapses, and because it's a static configuration and it collapses, that black hole has a finite mass. And so in both of those cases, you have this mass gap. On the other hand, every matter model that we know of, if you give it sufficient kinetic energy, gets into an effectively massless regime, if you will, an asymptotically free regime, where potential terms, rest mass terms, et cetera, become irrelevant. And then the transition is always type 2 and is always characterized by a self-similar solution, which sits at the threshold of black hole formation. And two examples of these solutions. What's being plotted here is for massless scalar collapse. These oscillations are happening. This radial variable is logarithmic. And the time coordinate is slowing down exponentially. So these oscillations are happening faster and faster on smaller and smaller scales. If you can tune infinitely, you get an accumulation of these so-called echoes. And there's a singular point. And that singularity is naked because this evolution, as I said, is well bounded away from 2m over r being 1. It's not; it's almost a black hole, but it's not a black hole. So it was these kinds of solutions which ultimately forced Hawking to amend his bet with Preskill and Thorne to include the term generic, the generic collapse of regular initial data wouldn't lead to naked singularities. So there's a similar sort of solution for the Yang-Mills field. So this Yang-Mills field is interesting that it has both kinds of behavior. So again, these oscillations are happening at scale, and they're discrete. So it's a self-similarity, but it's a discrete self-similarity. And we conjecture that the phase diagram here is also fairly rich, namely that for very low gamma, we'll have no black holes. There'll be this sort of low intermediate level regime where we'll have a type 1 transition. and sitting at that type 1 transition will be one of these boson stars. Then there'll be another regime where there's no black hole formation again. And then there'll be a type 2 transition. And it's this type 2 transition which will generically appear in the collision of high-speed particles. Yes, sir.
Something rather interesting going to happen at that second boundary where the black hole is just about to not form.
Yeah.
And what is known about that?
Nothing.
Okay. Why do you expect that as a region there's again no black hole formation?
In here?
Yeah.
So you saw that twice, right? So
no, you're talking about the head-on collision.
Both, these were all head-on collisions. Okay, so in both of those cases, at low, at starting from rest, the collision produced a black hole, or starting with low initial velocities, but at higher velocities, but not very high, produced the subatomic behavior.
How do you know that the same will not repeat itself?
We don't, but it seems unlikely. Anyway, the question is, what exactly is that solution? Because we've got two fields coupled in, and so we have some idea of what's going to happen here, but for the type 2 solution, we really don't have much of an idea. I think Franz thinks it'll probably be a pure vacuum solution, that is, the matter won't matter. I suspect that it actually may be the massless scalar solution. Okay, and there's indications from other calculations that I've done, and that when you have more than one field coupled in, the threshold of black hole formation, especially for type 2 phenomena, that one field sort of generically wins.
The same mass? But I suppose that I think that the mass such that they have both type 1 and type 2 solutions.
Yeah.
The late time configuration of these two cases, how do they differ? I mean, they're both black holes with the same mass?
Here?
Yes.
They could be, but there'd be lots of energy that's dispersed to infinity, for example. Right?
So, so there's no late time solution in which they both become a black hole of mass M.
Well, there wouldn't be any significance to that, right? They could be the same mass, but that expresses a fraction of the total mass that you started with. Those fractions would be different. So them having the same mass at late times would sort of be an accident. Well, you'd have to tune in order to get that same mass.
Yes. Yeah, I was just slightly confused by the uniqueness of the solution.
No, there's no loss of uniqueness because the initial conditions aren't the same, right? So, you know, there's an infinite number of ways to form a black hole with a given mass dynamically,
mm-hmm.
right? And it doesn't change the uniqueness of that solution. It means that the dynamics of how it forms isn't important. What's important is what it settles down to at late times. Okay, so one last thing, though. If it's, and we certainly think it's a type 2 transition, to the extent that the classical picture really is a good description of what's going on, the standard picture which says that somehow when you get down to the Planck scale, that's the end of short-distance physics, also seems to be questionable, because what this tells us is that, you know, there's interesting effects that are coming in now at sub-Planck scale distances, and that they can basically go down to, you know, those arbitrarily small distances. Again, this is all predicated on, you know, the extent to which you can sort of ignore the H-bar effects. So that's the last thing that I want to leave you with. The Planck scale may not be the end of short-distance physics. So the standard picture for black hole formation seems to be okay. The use of this Exelbrink-Sexel solution also seems to be okay. We expect the results not to be sensitive to the details of the matter model. We have these questions about the threshold of black hole formation. And then getting back to this notion of crackpots, so one of the interesting things about working in this field is that, you know, it attracts a bit of attention. So one of the writers for Science Online, got in touch with us and wrote up a nice little article in Science Online on the work. And then even more interesting was the blogging or the conversation that goes on in response to that post. And this is my favorite part. So interesting how some articles just seem to draw in crackpots from all over the net like a supermassive black hole. So thanks for your attention.
Any other questions?
So is there any potential application? I guess you seem to think of motivation as finding out what happens when you have like high energy particle organisms. But if you believe that that's sort of implausible, that this is a good model for that, are there like other potential applications? Like, can astrophysically this happen?
Would be fairly unlikely there too. Perhaps in the early universe, but to get black holes, the relativistic velocities. Apart from sort of the instances where they're interacting with other black holes, in which case their peculiar velocity with respect to galaxies still tends to be, although it might be large, it's non-relativistic, that would seem to be highly implausible.
So for the LHC, it will or it won't work?
Well, if you believe the whole chain of argument, the standard line of reasoning, right, and the dimensions are just right so that the real Planck scale is TeV, is slightly above, then there's a possibility that black holes could be formed. Right? But that's still a fairly large number of assumptions and things that have to conspire correctly. So, I'm not a particle physics expert. I'm quoted as saying I'd be very surprised, but, lots of things would surprise me. Right? They will or won't happen.
And then it would eat the Earth?
Well, no, it wouldn't eat the Earth. I mean, the idea would be it would evaporate quite quickly. Okay.
So you mentioned that your conclusions are robust, independent of the model.
We expect them to be.
Right, but suppose I have some spectator fields that don't necessarily participate, but can feel through the gravitational. So the gravitational fields are collapsing scalar. So how would that change?
So
in particular, what I'm worried is that instead of formation of a black hole, you might seem to end up exciting all this extra fields that were.
Yeah. No, we certainly can't rule that out.
Because that's a particular situation which you would expect to be present in this extra dimension scenario. There are all these massive fields, lengths and moduli and sizes and KK modes. It will sit there, and somehow you assume that you just look at a particular single scalar field and a gravitational
effect. Right, exactly. So your idea there would be that somehow you'd be transferring energy to those before they got sufficiently compact.
Right. How much have you studied that?
Olshe has seen lots of collisions of cosmic rays with particles in the atmosphere with center of mass energy, TeV, and much greater. So do we learn anything from the fact that none of those have showed peculiar characteristics like exploding black holes?
I don't know. You'd have to ask the particle physics experts. Do we?
I don't know. I pass to cosmic ray expert. I mean, I think, the standard argument for why, black holes in the LHC aren't going to eat the Earth is from cosmic rays, right? Because from these collisions. But you're observing cosmic rays after a lot of showering and scattering. So how far you can...
Right, but my point is, so yes, we're confident that if special relativity is true up to a boost of TeV, that nothing's going to eat the Earth. But even more than that, maybe it's an issue of impact parameter, but the ordinary hadronization particle physics models describe those showers pretty well and what's expected from those showers, and black hole physics doesn't come in. So why wouldn't the same thing be true with the LHC?
No, but imagine we have been producing black holes in these cosmic ray collisions. How would you know?
Well, that's my question. If you can't know there,
well, I'm not
how
sure
would you
can.
Know if you'll see them in the LHC? How would they be different?
Oh, no, because they're still... So I think, if you have a super Planckian collision in the atmosphere, it's highly boosted, right? So we imagine the formation of this black hole, which Hawking radiates, gives you a big spray of particles in one direction. That looks to me like a cosmic ray anyway, right? But in the standard model, in the LHC, you're producing these things at rest. And so you expect spherically symmetric events, which look very different from your ordinary. I mean, you have a high multiplicity, high sphericity events, which look very different to ordinary particle collisions.
Well, so that sounds plausible, but has anybody tracked this down carefully?
I don't know.
Yeah, just getting, there was a question earlier about impact parameter, but if you said something about it, I missed it. Have you looked at what happens when they're
okay, not? Okay, so those calculations, again, you know, Franz has got a big chunk of money to build this, you know, personal cluster, and that's weeks on a cluster. And so to go to an extra dimension is another couple orders of magnitude more computer time, so. We need graduate students.
So the
answer, 10 years. All right,
so the answer is we only know about head-on collisions.
Yeah, that's right.
That's
good.
Last question. Yeah, going back to this classical ETA argument, I agree that you know if the energy is high enough, then the calculation is classical. But I would expect that the energy high enough means that gamma is above the oop. You know, an
yeah.
OOP value. So the region you're exploring here is quantum, so should be quantum. So in order to really have evidence for that, you should be able to.
Yeah. So
you should be able to go to gamma
right.
20 or
that's
whatever.
Right.
What is exactly so the really valid.
So the claim would be that you know we would expect to see. We think we're already in the kinetic energy dominated regime. So from the point of view of classical general relativity, we really don't expect to see anything significantly different if we started with a particle which had a much smaller value of compactness, that is 2m over r, so that we had to get gamma up to you know hundreds of thousands. So again, the claim is we're already kinetic energy dominated even though gamma is relatively low.
But can you already do it classically?
Well, that's what I'm doing, right? And so I'm saying that the reason we got it at such a low value of gamma was because these boson stars that we took were significantly self-gravitating to begin with. They had a mass that's a significant fraction of the Planck mass. But I don't expect to see anything different if I started with a boson star that had a mass a millionth and then had to boost to 3 million rather than to 3. The problem with going to high values of gamma is the cost of this calculation is at least going like the third power of gamma.
Okay. You say you're in the classical regime.
Well, we're definitely in the classical regime, but more than that, we're in the kinetic energy dominated regime. Okay, so that we're the rest mass effects are sort of negligible. So if we had to go to the gamma of 11 for these calculations, we wouldn't have been able to. So it's sort of fortuitous that it cut in sort of relatively low gammas compared to what it could have been.
Okay, just as an aside, Matt is here till Thursday next week, so he's teaching the Psi course, but then next week is off that task, so his office is 2:47 if you want to talk to him tomorrow.